This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This week, Maryland Governor Robert Ehrlich suggested that in the face of some problems with electronic voting machines in the state's recent primary, that the voting machines should be scrapped and replaced with good old-fashioned paper ballots. He later backed down from that proposal, calling for voters in the state to file paper absentee ballots instead. Now, there have been many stories about flaws with electronic voting systems, machines that don't work right, that are too easily hackable. There are also concerns that the workings of the machines aren't transparent. You really can't tell what's going on inside there, making it harder to put a voter's trust in the system. So how do we know that the voting machine hasn't already come preloaded with votes? You can't open it up, look inside like you can a mechanical lever, and see the counter set to zero. On the other hand, the electronic systems do allow for votes to be quickly counted, and they allow better accessibility to voters with disabilities. This hour, we're going to be talking about the electronic voting systems, their strengths, their weaknesses, how to improve them, what we should think of when we talk about them. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And, of course, you're always welcome to join us and to surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Ed Felton is a professor in the Department of Computer Science and the director of the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton University in Princeton, New Jersey. He joins us here in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Larry Norden is an associate counsel and director of the Voting Technology Assessment Project at the Brennan Center for Justice. That's at the NYU Law School here in New York. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira.
Let me begin with you, Ed. You wrote an article, actually, called "The Security Analysis of the Diebold AccuVote TS Voting Machine: A Scathing Analysis of This Voting Machine and the Possibility or How Easy It Is to Hack Into It." Tell us about this machine and what concerns you about it.
Sure. This is the voting machine that's used in the state of Maryland and the state of Georgia and overall by about 5% of U.S. voters. And along with my student colleagues Ari Feldman and Alex Halderman, our team looked at one of these machines. We managed to get our hands on it. We took it apart to see how it worked, what were the security mechanisms, and what we discovered was that some very serious security attacks on this machine were possible.
Mm-hmm. And how were they possible?
Well, essentially, the machine, like every electronic voting machine, is just a computer, and so it's subject potentially to some of the same problems that any computer would have. Mm-hmm. In this case, a virus. And what we found was that there is essentially no defense in this system against a computer virus. And we were able to build a demonstration computer virus that can spread from one voting machine to another and then flip votes almost undetectably in a real election.
This could go out the whole voting system, wherever these machines are used?
Wherever these machines are used, if the virus can spread through right. The whole population, it could potentially steal a large number of votes.
Did you tell Diebold about this?
Of course. They're well aware of this. We told them and we told public officials and the public because we thought that people needed to know.
And where does this machine stand? It's still being used as a standard machine?
Yes, the machine, the same equipment that we studied is being used by about 5% of U.S. voters.
Mm-hmm. Larry, what's your reaction to this?
Well, I was very happy to see Professor Felton's report. It certainly isn't something that surprised us at the Brennan Center. We worked with a task force of security experts and computer scientists from both the government and private sector over the past year and a half, and we identified many problems, not just with Diebold, but with all electronic voting machines. As Professor Felton mentioned, this is something that essentially computers, they run on a lot of software. There are a lot of opportunities for people with bad motives, if they have them, to take advantage of that fact. And mm-hmm. And as we also know, there are plenty of reliability problems with these machines as well.
Why is that? Is it because they were rushed to meet the standards or to the legal system?
I think a big part of it is that there was this the Help America Vote Act was passed in 2002. It did a lot of good things. But one of the things that it set in motion was this a massive transformation in the United States as to what kinds of voting systems we're using. Mm-hmm. Just this year alone, 31 million Americans will vote on new voting systems for the first time. When you have that kind of a massive implementation of new technology across the country, they're bound to be problems with it.
Mm-hmm. Are Americans more trustworthy of the old system or of the new system, or any new electronic system?
That's a good question. I'm not sure of the answer to that. What I can say is one of the reasons that the Brennan Center got involved in this is because our work revolves around promoting effective democracy, and we were concerned there seemed to be an increasing controversy over whether or not these machines were safe and reliable. And I think one of the worst things that you can imagine in a democracy is that people don't have confidence that their votes are going to be counted.
And they begin to think that there are conspiracy theories about this.
Absolutely.
And especially with the Diebold machine, we know Mr. Diebold was very close to the Republican Party.
That's right. In the run-up to the 2004 election, the chairman of Diebold said turned out to be a leading fundraiser for the Bush campaign in Ohio. And if you're inclined to conspiracy theories, this is obviously something you're going to latch onto.
So when you hacked into this machine, did you find it was just sloppily programmed, or was it a conspiracy?
No, it didn't look like a conspiracy to us. What it looked like was a system that was designed with relatively little attention to security.
Mm-hmm. Certainly,
I think a devious conspirator would have done a much better job of hiding the backdoors that were in the system.
Mm-hmm. So how should a good secure system be made?
Well, there are a lot of details that you have to get right. Mm-hmm. Certainly one of the lessons that experience teaches in computer security is get the details right. And obviously, probably neither you or your audience wants to have that detailed discussion right now.
Right.
But that's why it's important to have experts look at the systems. But there are some safeguards that we can put in place that everyone can easily understand. One of them is a voter-verified paper audit trail that creates a paper record of your vote and how you meant to cast it, which can be used afterward in case there's any dispute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, and I would add to that, this is something that we spent a lot of time on. Having an audit trail by itself, I would say, isn't necessarily enough. At this point in the United States, we have 35 states that have either mandated by law or just as a matter of what they chose, have machines that have voter-verified paper audit trails. But if that paper isn't actually being looked at afterwards, if it isn't being audited, and the fact of the matter is, in the vast majority of states that have these paper trails, they're not looking at the paper afterwards as a matter of routine, then I'm not sure how much added security that paper will have.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to the phones. Joe in Macomb, Illinois. Hi, Joe.
Good afternoon.
Hi there.
Hi. I've been an election judge here for I can't tell you how long, and have handled everything from punch cards up to a machine very similar to what you're talking about, except it was not made by that company. One thing I'll say right off the start, and I can't remember who this quote is from, but if you try to make something idiot-proof, they'll just go and invent a better idiot. So, everything's going to have problems. But the new machine that we used in this last primary worked real well for us. It was a touchscreen computer. It allowed review. The voter could scroll back and forth, change votes. They could do write-ins. It also had a paper trail, which was the one problem we did have with the machine. The printer kept jamming on us. Mm-hmm. But besides that, it worked quite well. And we had one voter who has voted in my precinct for years. She's totally blind, comes in with a guide dog, and in the past, two election judges have always had to go into the voting booth with her, one from the Democratic Party, one from the Republican Party. We read the races to her and the choices, and she has to give us her answer. And the two, one from each party is there to verify that the proper circle is filled in on the ballots. With this new system, she was able to put on some headphones and do the voting entirely by herself, and she was just so elated. She made the comment afterwards that in all her years of voting, this was the first time she'd ever been able to cast a private ballot, and she was able to do it unassisted. Mm-hmm. And she was just so enthused by that You know, the problems are there, yes, but I think that moving forward and helping people out with disabilities, I think it's worth the effort and worth working out the problems to make the systems go.
Thanks, Joe, for calling.
Yeah, I would agree with that comment very much. There are many benefits to electronic voting, and not least of which is they have the potential anyway to allow disabled voters who make up a very large percentage of disabled. There are about 40 million disabled people of voting age, according to the 2000 census, potentially vote independently in private. I would say that I think in many cases those things like the audio ballot need to be improved. They're not necessarily always usable for voters, but that's certainly an area where electronic voting machines add a lot to the voting process. What I would say, though, is that, as I mentioned before, there has been this huge transformation in the country and the systems that we vote on, and we have to catch up in terms of the procedures that we have in place to make sure that what happened in Maryland just last week, where voters were turned away from the polls because poll workers and officials didn't get everything right. That should never happen. People shouldn't be turned away when they come to the polls. That's one of the worst things that can happen in a democracy. People set aside an hour to vote in the morning. They can't necessarily come back to vote later. And there are things that we can do. We can make sure that there are enough emergency paper ballots available at a polling place so that if something does go wrong, which inevitably somewhere in the United States it will, because something always does go wrong, that people aren't turned away, that they can vote.
We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk with more with Ed Felton, professor in the Department of Computer Science and director of the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton, and Larry Norden, associate counsel and director of the Voting Technology Assessment Project at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU Law School. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking about voting machine security this hour with Ed Felton and Larry Norden. We were talking about the Diebold machine and about other machines. Is there a standard for every machine that it works the same way, all the voting machines, Larry?
There certainly isn't. There are, depending on what county you're in, and even sometimes in the same county, you may find a different voting machine when you go to vote.
And that must be a problem.
It's a problem in the sense that there are some designs that are better than others, I think, and particularly one of the things that we studied was the usability of the systems, the ballots, how confusing they are to voters. And certainly anybody who remembers the 2000 election remembers Palm Beach County. Sometimes the way ballots are set up can confuse people and lead them to make choices that they didn't intend to. So I think that in that area there's the potential for great improvement.
Let's talk about that. What would be a good way to look at the screen? You have a screen, yeah. a computer screen, and what would be a bad computer screen?
Well, for touch screens, if you're actually looking at a computer screen, one of the things we found is to have every race and every candidate on the screen as some screens are designed is not a good idea. It's overwhelming to the voters. It's confusing. So you could have, you know, five candidates in each race, 10 races. If it's all at once, what happens is voters miss some of the races. A lot of private vendors in other areas have learned this lessons, and that's why when you go to an ATM machine, you're not asked all at once, how much money do you want to withdraw? What's your code? Do you want a receipt? You're asked those questions each separately. When voters are presented with information that way, there's a much greater chance that they're actually going to get all of their intended votes in and recorded accurately.
So making them more like the ATM machine, you know, where you get menus, you press one choice, you go to the next menu, the next menu.
Yeah, actually, absolutely. For touch screen voting machines, that's the best design. Unfortunately, in a lot of states like New Jersey and Delaware and potentially here in New York, they have either purchased or are looking at purchasing these huge, on top of everything, they're gigantic, which makes them more expensive to deal with, these huge screens where you have a million choices basically at once.
Mm-hmm. Can a town or a county bring its own auditors in to check the count of the machine, to verify it? Can you go inside the machine and do that?
I'm not sure if I understand what you mean. You can certainly look at the totals that the machine has provided and check them against whatever was recorded in the county.
But let's say I get the machine Ed, and I want to make sure there's nothing in it. It's blank. It's no pre-votes. The pre-counts are inside. Can I do that?
Not really. It's difficult fundamentally to understand what's happening inside a computer system to start with. And on top of that, often the contracts under which states and counties buy the machines will prohibit the states and counties from bringing in independent experts to really thoroughly examine the voting machines. One of the things that's really held back public understanding of these technologies and their risks is that the vendors have been pretty successful at keeping researchers like our team away from the machines and stopping us from really being able to take them apart and see what's good and bad about them.
That's why you had to get surreptitiously that Diebold machine.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't say it was surreptitious, but it was, I think, a stroke of luck that we were able to get it.
And so when the machine comes in, you have to take it on face value that the supplier, whoever that is, has zeroed it out and everything is kosher inside the machine.
That's right. And you pretty much have to take it on face value that it's running the software that it's supposed to be running, that there's nothing malicious in there. And then it's going to work accurately.
Why can't we create an open standard and an open source for that?
There's been some push toward creating an open source voting technology. Unfortunately, it hasn't had a lot of success in the market. These efforts started after the existing vendors had a pretty good head start. And unfortunately, the Help America Vote Act, which Larry referred to before, gave states a pot of money to spend, mostly over a limited period of time, to buy machines.
Fire. Yeah, and I'll tell you, there's another problem with not having some kind of open source that I've seen a lot of jurisdictions confront. Once the machines are sold, the vendor basically has a monopoly over those machines and any kind of updates there are to the machines, any kind of work that needs to be done on the machines. They're the only ones that know what's in those machines. So, for instance, New Jersey has a situation now, and a lot of states have had this situation, where they passed a voter verified paper law. Suddenly they have to have printers added on to these machines. The vendor's in a position where they know nobody else can provide that printer but them, because they're the only ones that know what's in the machines. And the vendors charge, unfortunately, often exorbitant amounts to add those printers. So it puts jurisdictions at a tremendous disadvantage.
Mm-hmm. And having the paper trail is key to these voting machines, right?
We really think it's key to being able to count on the result. And it's also key as a backup against some kind of glitch or failure. The reason it's important is that paper records don't fail catastrophically in the way that electronic ones do. Once the paper record is printed, it doesn't get unprinted. It doesn't disappear if the power fails and the battery isn't working. It can't be infected, corrupted by a virus, and so on.
Well, and it's a form of verification in the end. Things can happen to paper. A building can burn down. Somebody could steal the paper. But in the end, it's one check against another, and
right.
That should make everybody more confident
right.
that their votes are counted.
The key is that the electronic records and the paper records fail in different ways and at different times. And so you're much better with the sort of belt and suspenders approach of having them both.
Let's say we had a clean slate and we were to start over and create electronic voting. What would be the best way to do this?
I think you'd want to start out by ensuring that you had some kind of transparency so that the public and public officials could really look inside the machines and have them evaluated however they liked.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is the most important safeguard that we're lacking, one of the most important safeguards we're lacking right now.
And then you might want to find the best screen, the best
Absolutely.
Input system, and make that standard. So you move from state to state or county to county, you're seeing the same screen again.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that could be a great help, no question about
it. And who could take this job over?
You mean who could mandate something
like
this?
Who could not just mandate it, but would you create a whole new voting section of the government, or would it be?
Well, there is an Election Assistance Commission right now that sets up a lot of the guidelines for what voting systems should be like, and I think in many ways they've done a very good job. I think that they could do a better job in other ways, but that could be an organization that might take over something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I do think the Election Assistance Commission has been a step in the right direction. Unfortunately, they have not had a lot of resources, and it takes a long time in this kind of bureaucratic process to have an influence.
And we are living in a very polarized electorate now.
Yeah.
How do we make sure that you don't believe the other guy has put those ballots or has his finger on or her finger on the button.
Well, again, I think what Ed pointed to is a good way, one good way of dealing with that. The situation that we don't want is another 2000 election that's decided by 500 votes. And look, there have been other situations like that even more recently. The governor's race in Washington State just a couple of years ago was decided by basically 100 votes. And those things happen. It seems like they happen more and more often. The last thing you want is for there to be no way to check that the results were accurately recorded.
And you said one of the worst things is to turn people away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If we computerize everything, if your name doesn't match exactly, you know, if you have a driver's license and you're Joe and Joel or something, could that be a problem for
a
computer system?
I think that is a potential problem. There's been a under the Help America Vote Act, there is a new requirement that these statewide databases be created, and a lot of states are confronting this issue right now. What do you do when somebody's driver's license, which is where you might be getting names from for the database, doesn't match exactly the name that they're they're providing on the voter rolls? Mm-hmm. So that actually, I'm afraid that might be a situation for me here in New York, because on my birth certificate it says Lawrence, on my driver's license it says Larry. I don't know what's going to happen when New York State has its new database. If I show up, if they're going to tell me that I can't vote.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the human element in voting, which will always be there. You'll always have someone, I think, sitting at the front desk in the polling place making judgment calls about situations like this, and you may have people challenging it afterward.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in here. Brian in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Hi, Brian.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a comment about effective democracy, and it seems to me the most important thing is voter participation. And I don't see the electronic voting actually increasing the number of people that vote. I think the strain on local election officials is going to be very great. I think the lack of confidence is going to keep people away. And I think the focus should be on trying to get more people to vote rather than the whatever less than 50% of people that currently do vote for the big elections. That's my comment.
All right. Thanks. Ed?
Well, absolutely. Confidence is a key all around, that people need to be able to trust the technology to count the votes right. One of the potential drawbacks of electronic voting, especially the first time you use it, is that it can take voters longer to vote. And we saw examples of this in Ohio in the 2004 election, where the lines were extremely long in some places. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe that's just the first time or the first few times, and we'll get past that. But it's still something to think about.
Now, I would say I don't think identifying where the system could be more open and what the potential security problems are in the end is going to decrease confidence. I think it's going to increase confidence. The more people understand the way the system works, the more they can participate in. And one of the things that we recommend is that when there are audits, when machines are chosen to be audited and paper trails, that the public sees what's going on. And if you increase that confidence and you increase the public investment in the whole process, I do believe that ultimately that will increase voter turnout.
Are we ever going to be headed toward electronic voting from home? On the internet, something like, are people working on that concept?
I think that some people are hopeful about that. I and you can ask Professor Felton what he thinks about this. I think a lot of computer scientists think that might be a security nightmare.
I think it is a security nightmare. It may eventually happen, but right now the internet is kind of a wild west, and there's all kinds of spyware, viruses, and all of this running around. And I think it would be very tempting to someone to try to use the spyware viruses that are out there to swing an election. It becomes much easier when you're doing it over the internet.
Yeah, because then you really leave yourself open to hacking through the internet.
Anything that can happen to your PC could happen to the election then.
But on the other hand, if you could get that figured out, you'd have the potential to increase participation would be enormous.
It would be a lot easier for a lot of people to vote. Although some parts of the population don't have the kind of access to the internet that that many of us are fortunate enough to have. But still, I don't think it's worth increasing the risk of fraud to that extent in order to get more people to vote.
And there's certainly other things that you could do to increase voter participation, having early voting, having same-day registration, so that if somebody says, you know what, I'm really interested in this race, they didn't have to have registered 6 months ago. They could come to the polling place and say, I want to vote now. Here's my information, and vote.
Mm. What do you think it's going to get to get the Maryland governor back online here? What kind of, you know, you think he has to be, people like him, I don't mean him specifically, you have to really see this working and be confident about it before they are ready to throw away those paper ballots?
Well, I think he's right to be skeptical about this November's election. Maryland is in a spot where they have the particular machines they have with only a few short weeks before the election. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's a crazy idea at all to consider going to an all-paper voting system for this election. And then to think about what to do about the problem in the longer term.
Because it's going to be the presidential election just two years down the road.
That's right. And it's not too early to start thinking about what technology we're going to be using then.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about voting this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Do you see this as something that is a really a pressing issue that has to be taken care of very quickly in this election cycle, or certainly before the next presidential election?
I do. This election, like every election, is important. We're talking about possibly the control of the House of Representatives, potentially the Senate being at stake. We're talking about important statewide election races, and I do think that we need to have confidence in every election.
Now, really, what's more important than who's governing our nation?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the one thing we have, certainly the democracy holds out to everybody else, is the ability to vote, and that your vote is counted, and it's accurate.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I think that there are things we can do short term, there are things that we can certainly do for this next election, and then there are things that we should be thinking longer term in the next couple of years. As I said, short term, having emergency ballots available for everybody so that when they get to the polls, if the machines break down, they can vote is really important. Making sure that the paper that's in these 35 states where there are voter verified paper records, that they're being audited afterwards, that they're looking at 1 or 2% of those votes and saying, of the paper and saying, does it match the electronic record? Was the electronic record accurate? Those things would go a great way in this next election, I think, not only to making the election more secure and making us more sure, but making the public more sure that their votes were recorded accurately.
And how about flexibility with the closing time? We know that we're in a learning curve.
Yeah.
You know, judges or whoever, you know, are responsible to lengthening the hours.
Absolutely. And I mean, that is what they did in Maryland when they had these problems. They extended, they opened the polls for another couple of hours. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly something I think jurisdictions should be prepared to do ahead of time if there are problems.
Should we create a voting machine that's just a voting machine? In other words, not a PC that's been converted to one?
Well, I think it is worthwhile to have equipment that's specialized, but still,
right.
Even if you do that, when you open it up, it's ultimately at bottom of a computer and is going to face some of the same problems.
Mm-hmm. So it's getting the security no matter what computer it is.
That's right. You have to get the details right, and it's important that it be transparent, just like the rest of our voting processes.
And how will we go about doing that in the short term?
In the short term, it's going to be difficult. In the longer term, I think we can have changes in laws. I think we can have changes in the relationship between the voting machine vendors and public officials. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to keep pushing for more transparency throughout this process.
And I would say just generally more focus on reliability and security. I think there was, understandably perhaps after what happened in the 2000 election, a rush to find new machines. There's no question that in the past couple of years, people and jurisdictions have been thinking about security more and more often. And I think that that's a very positive step, and that's we're only going to have as long as the public stays on top of this, we're only going to have more secure procedures mm-hmm. in the coming years.
So there was this initial rush, everybody, after that debacle of an election. Everybody mm-hmm. said, let's get these machines. And now you're both saying, let's pull back and make sure we do it right.
Absolutely, yeah. I think if there's any lesson to come out of the past couple of years with electronic voting machines, that's the key one.
Mm-hmm. Make sure we get this thing done right, because it's going to be around for a long time.
Yeah.
All right, I want to thank both of you gentlemen for taking time to be with me. Ed Felton is a professor in the Department of Computer Sciences and director of the Center for Information Technology Policy at Princeton University in Princeton, New Jersey, of course. Larry Norden is an associate counsel and the director of the Voting Technology Assessment Project. That's at the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU Law School here in New York. Gentlemen, thank you both for taking time to be with us.
Thanks so much.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about a new kind of silicon chip, a new chip that actually can create a laser light. Put in the juice and laser light comes out of it. What can you do with that? Kind of interesting. We'll talk about it. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.